This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
They modified food to feed everybody. And I peel it back to when I was a kid, which was, let's say, 40, 50 years ago, when you never considered eating asparagus in the winter or strawberries in the winter. I mean, it was, right. We ate things seasonally. And it, in fact, I mean, it was the way that I was raised, it just seemed normal. And then I don't know when it was, maybe 20 years ago, I started seeing all these strange fruits and vegetables in the supermarket. Not just in the supermarket, in the food co-op. Even mm-hmm. and the local natural food store at all times out of season, and I started learning. Oh, it's all because of refrigeration and stuff like that. And right. at that time, cheap fuel prices that we could be eating things that came from all around the world. But then there was an issue that I discovered pretty quickly, which was I get that asparagus from Chile in January. It tastes like wood. I get those strawberries from California, which are raised not for taste but for shipping ability. They taste like wood. So there's a reason to be eating seasonally and locally. And I wonder if we can, if a part of rebuilding our food shed, as you talk about, is also part of us learning how to appreciate the importance and the necessity of eating seasonally, and that connotes actually eating locally.
Right. Well, you know, perhaps, in a joking manner, we could consider all of it about palates and palates. It's both the palate and the sense of taste, which also I think is ultimately tied to nutrition very often, and then also, the palates in which we're shipping things around all over the world. And, the more we can do in order to build out these local food systems, I think the better. And, it's just a given that the fresher the food, the more the higher it is in nutritional content. So, by knocking out this whole notion of taste, we also take care of this, a lot of the nutritional issues, and really reinvesting in our own communities. And things really start to be much more sensible when we look at it in this fashion. But it is an adjustment, both of those kinds of palates, to be sure.
Now, you write in your book that actually if you were to flash freeze vegetables and fruits right in the field after they're picked, they have perhaps higher nutritional content than if they're picked and shipped 20 miles, let's say they picked out in the fields around Portland and then shipped into one of our local food stores and we buy it the next day and then it sits in our house for a couple days. That's one of those possible facts that would alarm people who are really into fresh local food. So how do you, first of all, what's the substantiation for saying that immediately frozen food is healthier for you than eating fresh picked but not immediately eating it?
Right. Yeah, we had a nutritionist come here to the college a couple of years ago, and I actually asked him to disabuse us of, some of the ideas we had about, some of the organic and local foods in some cases. And it was a point that he made quite clear, and he did it, with research that really made a lot of sense, that and just laid out different fruits and vegetables and looking at what happens in terms of storage and nutritional decline. And, it is really pretty amazing just how quickly, if things aren't appropriately, frozen or refrigerated, just how quickly the nutrient value of those foods goes down. So that was a little bit disturbing. And, really what it means in terms of local farmers markets is, not that those foods can't be as nutritious as those perhaps in California or elsewhere that are, flash frozen as soon as they're picked or canned. But in fact, what it means is we probably need to be more careful about the handling practices at the local level because, it isn't too infrequent that you go to a farmer's market and food has been sitting out, for fruits and vegetables for a number of hours, and there is a market decline in the nutritional value. So better handling can ultimately yield better nutrition.
Now, at the grocery store where I shop, where the vegetables and fruits, the fruits are definitely not refrigerated at all. Now, the vegetables are in those cases that vegetables are in, and they get spritzed every so often, but I'm also assuming there's no mild refrigeration. So are fruits and vegetables that sit around in a grocery store going to also lose their nutritional value?
They do, and it was a little bit surprising when this friend Peter came through and did his analysis and talked to us about the different fruits and vegetables. And, many of them, once it gets beyond 36 to 48 hours, the nutritional value, is in decline, 50% or more in many cases.
So, well, for me, that's an argument to grow your own garden.
Oh, well, yep. I think that's right.
When I first came to Portland, and I had grown up in the East Coast and lived in New York for a while, and Actually, I grew up in a small city in central New England that was surrounded by farms when I grew up, or not surrounded by farms so much, but there were definitely farms around. And we used to go out to this farm a couple times a week and buy corn that was fresh picked. So I was familiar with, from early childhood memories, of how good fresh corn, freshly picked corn was, which is something you couldn't find in New York City at all. But when I came to Portland, I had friends who grew up here who told me that corn was not worth eating unless, you know, it been picked no more than 2 hours before you ate it. And I discovered that that was also true with tomatoes, which I'd never liked until I started growing my own tomatoes. And discovered that tomatoes that you freshly pick off the bush are completely different from even in-season tomatoes that you buy at the store. So there's that reality, but how does that translate into something that everybody can do? Because that seems to be another big issue about the local food movement, is it seems to be, it can be exclusive.
Right. You know, if we're not really paying attention, I do believe it can be exclusive, you know, if not elitist. And that's one of the really the main arguments in the book is, you know, how can we actually get beyond that? And one of the ways I think we can do it is, you know, by moving from local foods to local food systems, and ultimately really to thinking about community-based food systems. And, you know, how can we provide access to the largest number of people possible?
So what do you mean by what do you mean by a food system?
Right. You know, so the food system, you know, ultimately in its most complex form, really being everything from the farming, the agricultural acts, if you will, you know, the production, to the processing, storage, distribution, marketing, retailing, wholesaling. So, you know, how all of that comes together. And then at the very end, the recapture, the resource recovery, if you will. So how do we actually, you know, whatever's left over, how do we bring that back into the system, make sure it doesn't disappear? So, you know, the system in the best case scenario, in my view, is really a soil-to-soil system, you know, where we start with good, healthy soils, and we make sure we recapture everything possible and put that back in there.
So how does that make sure that everybody's going to have access to this good, healthy food? Because there are a number of farms, at least around here, I know quite a few farms that are using really excellent sustainable practices and are really working on their soil and also eliminating as much waste as possible, and they do direct marketing and all that stuff. And some of them, I think, are affordable and some of them are not. But the problem is that the one farm that I work with actually quite a bit, and they're quite affordable, but they can't feed everybody in the Portland area, let alone in the nation. So how do we apply these, what you're considering, like the soil-to-soil, truly sustainable practices, into a system that will actually feed everybody and not just people who can afford to pay a lot of money for their food?
Right, and, you know, it's a huge and tough question, as you well know, and I think there are different ways we can approach it, and the more diversification we use in really trying to tackle this, the better. So, you know, one could start with community gardens, and those can be subsidized in various ways, such that people can have their own garden space. You know, certainly just what people are able to do in their backyards or on their balconies or terraces, that's a help. It only gets us so far. There's no question about that. Farmers markets, you know, when people are going and buying fresh produce, being able to use their SNAP benefits, you know, what we formerly called food stamps, that's helpful. Now we have the EBT machines, the electronic banking transfer machines at farmers markets. Some farmers markets are providing folks who have SNAP benefits with double purchasing power. So that's one way of moving this forward. And, you know, then there are also efforts to do things at the so-called, you know, healthy corner stores, you know, places like Walgreens, different parts of the places around the country where, in some cases, small neighborhood stores, trying to find ways in some of those most beleaguered areas to get some fruits and vegetables in there. You know, and granted, they're not necessarily all local, but that is part of the effort. So it's incredibly complex. There's no question about that. And certainly, you know, as different places are trying to do things, you know, like cooking lessons, cooking for life, as it's called in some places, you know, that's a help. But, you know, it's a long, long process, and it really is something that there are no immediate answers, and I think we just have to keep trying and realize that this is something we have to build out over the course of at least a generation and really be careful and vigilant in watching it and just trying to do better all the time. I think that's the best we can do.
Well, I'm talking this morning with Philip Ackerman Leist, who's author of Rebuilding the Food Shed, and we're talking about how do we really rebuild local food systems so that we can all of us eat local healthy food and also sustain our communities locally. In your book, you mention one of the most famous urban agriculture projects, which is the D-Town Farm in Detroit. And I've been working with another very inspiring urban agriculture program in Richmond, California called Urban Tilth. And the two groups got to meet each other about 6 weeks ago. And we're going to have a report back on that from the director of Urban Tilth on this show in a few weeks. But I've been in touch with her, and she was very inspired by it. Now, one of the things that really struck me, I mean, Richmond, California is a pretty hard town, and it's got lots and lots of problems. And it's a place that most people in the Bay Area kind of like to ignore, because it's where, you know, it's where all the industry is, it's where all the refineries are, and a lot, much higher concentration of poorer people there than any place else in the Bay Area. But when the Urban Tilth people got to Detroit and they were coming in from the airport, they felt like they had entered a war zone.
Right.
And so let's talk a little bit about, because you visited D-Town Farm, let's talk a little bit about the issues in Detroit and how they are actually encouraging a new kind of urban agriculture that may actually move towards being self-sufficient for a neighborhood that doesn't, or a city that doesn't have any other access to food anymore.
Yeah, you know, Detroit, I think, fascinates so many of us, in part because there are so many vacant lots. As you say, you drive through and it really does, and it feels as much like a war zone, certainly, as anywhere that I've been in my lifetime. You know, really astounding to drive through there. So it's the potential of having open land within the context of a city, I think, that is partly so fascinating. And the other part is that, you know, it's so incredibly beleaguered, and yet there are these seeds of hope, if you will, that have sprung up, and people have done such an amazing job at really coming to the table and trying to figure out solutions that make sense for their communities, very often their neighborhoods. So D-Town Farm is a wonderful example. When I visited 2 years ago, it was at 2 acres. Now it's already at 5 acres. And it's really blossomed. Just an amazing project. As you know, they're working now, as you probably know, with Growing Power, Will Allen's regional outreach training centers. And so it's a fascinating place to look. And you know, they have to start with the soil, with the remediation of the soil, and then try to build things outward. So it's a great place to look, and certainly a model that all of us are watching to see how far this can actually go in terms of self-sufficiency.
Now, how much food are they actually able to produce?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's a study on Detroit agriculture that's come out, and they've got different variables that they sort of cast at the equation here to try to figure out, you know, what is the potential. And, you know, according to them, and looking at fruits and vegetables, depending upon, you know, how much vacant land is used, which kinds of lots are actually utilized, and actually the skill level of the farmers who are actually practicing here, they're trying to look at that and determine how far they can go. And they've come up with figures anywhere from 30 to, I believe, 60% of fruit and vegetable production. You know, I question whether that might be a little bit high. I mean, there is a preponderance of vacant land there in Detroit. But as a friend of mine actually there at Portland State University, Nathan McClintock, has noted, he's a geographer who actually studied the Oakland food system. You know, and Nathan pointed out with Oakland in particular that, you know, there it looks like with the vacant lots, maybe Oakland can get to 5% in terms of its fruits and vegetables, possibly 10% if you've really got a savvy group of farmers. So, you know, certainly getting up to 50% is pretty optimistic in my view, but nonetheless, you know, there's nothing wrong with people trying to do the extraordinary.
Well, Urban Tilth's goal is to grow 10% of the food that the city of Richmond would be able to eat. And mm-hmm. They're not there yet. And they have they had a major setback last summer when the Richmond Chevron refinery blew up, or it caught massively on fire. And they're still not sure about how safe the soil is in their gardens, which are just down the street from the refinery. So those are the kinds of issues that you're dealing with in urban agriculture that are very different from your lovely little farm in Vermont.
Right. It's a huge difference, and I think all of us who are lucky enough to live in landscapes, you know, like I do, it's really important for us to remember just how privileged we are in this kind of a situation, and you know, hopefully to provide whatever resources we can to help build this thing out, you know, in the urban areas as well. But if nothing else, at least be mindful of the challenges there.
Well, I have a fascination with urban agriculture, and. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I have a little bit of caution about the over enthusiasm that some people have about it. I mean, I've run into a lot of young people who are gardening, probably on garden plots about the size of the one I have in my backyard, who are calling themselves farmers. And I want to say to them, spend a few hours on a farm and understand what farmers do, because I think that when people who are gardeners in the city think of themselves as farmers, it's a nice little fantasy, but it in some ways dismisses just the incredible hard work of being a farmer, and also doesn't appreciate the amount of food that farmers need to grow in order to feed us all. So I wonder how we, at the same time that we encourage urban agriculture, we also try to inject a certain amount of realism into the idealism of some young, quote, urban farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think we've done a good enough job, Barbara, just in terms of linking, you know, urban farmers, urban gardeners, and just urban dwellers, you know, with rural dwelling farmers and others. You know, this thing of flows back and forth between cities and rural areas is something that I think we haven't really tapped into enough, and also the knowledge base, you know, exchanging knowledge back and forth is really important. And in the process of working on the book, I interviewed Erica Allen, Will Allen's daughter, who runs Growing Powers Operation in Chicago. And Erica was very wise, I think, in pointing out, and based on her father's experiences, that, you know, too often in urban areas, you know, the farmers don't have enough skills. I mean, there is a you know, just the level of production that's necessary on a you know, even a small, much less a medium or large scale farm is pretty incredible. So trying to find ways to actually transfer that knowledge back and forth and really figure out the innovative possibilities there. You know, I think we can do a much, much better job at that.
Well, I've been finding one of the best places for me to get information about how to grow vegetables and fruits is at the farmers market. And mm-hmm. we have a really nice relationship with this farm. That's one of the farms featured in our film, and we have been belonging to their CSA for the last few years, and I actually was buying from them years before I even thought we'd be making this film. But I was at the market yesterday, and it's been a beautiful, unseasonably warm couple weeks here in Portland, and so I'm thinking about planting strawberries about 2 weeks earlier, or tomatoes about 2 weeks earlier than I normally do. So I went up to the farmer, and I asked him, well, I see you have all these tomato plants and pepper plants and eggplants, you know, is it really time to plant yet? And he said, yes, tomatoes, yes, peppers do next week, eggplants do 2 weeks from now. And I think people, because there's a lot of exuberance when it's a beautiful day in Portland, everybody puts in their garden and then half the plants die. And I've had interesting conversations with farmers at the farmers markets about how they sell the plants because people want to buy them, but they make a lot of money because people have to keep coming back and buying more plants. And I think if people thought of the farmers market as also like an extension service and mm-hmm. that they actually could learn a lot more about gardening from them, it's a beginning. And
absolutely.
My concern is that getting more people to the farmers markets, because there's a perception, and I think it's somewhat undeserved, that they're expensive and exclusive and elitist. But and some are, but I think a lot of them aren't. And I wonder what your take on that one.
Yeah, you know, they really do seem to vary. And I know here in Vermont, in part, it depends on which farmers markets you choose to shop at. You know, there's certain ones that are located within, you know, relatively exclusive areas or places where they know there are a lot of second homeowners who are coming in during the summer months, and, you know, you see a market increase in terms of the prices. But, you know, when you compare what you can do in terms of fresh food, fresh produce, in most cases, compared to what you actually would pay if you buy it, you know, frozen or prepared otherwise, you know, in most cases you come out equal, if not better. And, you know, again, if the handling has been good in terms of nutrient value, it actually exceeds that. So, you know, I think a lot of it really depends upon the prudence of the shopper and, you know, knowing which markets to go to and frankly, which things to buy. And, you know, even folks like myself, you know, if I go to a farmer's market and, you know, see tomatoes that are $6 a pound, that just, you know, we grow them at home, but I just really hesitant, you know, to pay a price like that. So I think we've got to be careful, and we've also made local a value-added proposition, which is good in and of itself, but, you know, what will the market bear? That's the real question.
Well, I also want to talk about sort of the limitations of scale. I mean, like, mm-hmm. what we could grow in our own backyards and in our community gardens, and what we can grow in small farms close to town. And then this other big need, which really has not been addressed very much by the local food movement, which is staples, grains, mm-hmm. beans, seeds. And in our film, we're actually featuring a farm that's the largest grass seed farm in the Willamette Valley, which is transitioning to growing organic grains.
And great.
Because one of the farmer's wife is very visionary, and she's been pushing this old codger farmer, he's my age, you know, to like, you know, who's been growing grass seed all his life, to start thinking. And he's really on the bandwagon now. He's really jumped on to being an organic farmer. But I think that we haven't really thought, I mean, that there's not a lot of emphasis in the local food movement about grains. I'm wondering, first of all, why do you think that is? And do you think it's important that we start thinking about sourcing our grains locally as well as our fruits and vegetables?
Right. You know, you bring out a lot of ironies there. And one of the things I learned when I got to Vermont was that the Champlain Valley here in Vermont was actually the breadbasket of the East for a number of years. And, you know, that's kind of surprising. And so there's a resurgence of small-scale local grains that are being grown here and grown at reasonable prices, too. And a friend of mine, you know, produces some of those, and they're fantastic. It's, you know, it's a harder thing to do. And in part, I think the reason it's not happening quite as much is that it's not just so machinery-dependent in most cases, but, you know, the farmer who's doing that also has to be a heck of a mechanic. That's one of the lessons I've learned as I've watched people, you know, really begin again in terms of, you know, the grain harvest here in New England. You know, it's not just the mechanization and the cost of that in order to be able to do it, you know, cost effectively and competitively, but it's also the ability just to be able to work on your own machinery with the combines and other things that are required there. So I think that's one of the complications. The other is we've just fallen into such, you know, such comfort, really, with being able to get our grains at the grocery store or even the co-op and not think too much about it. It's something we're just beginning to raise the salience of at this point. You know, and I think they're grains and then also they're legumes. And in some ways, you know, I wonder if we shouldn't start, you know, or at least emphasize even more the legumes at the beginning here, because those are, they've just really been neglected. And those are things that don't necessarily have to have the same level of mechanization as you do for the production of grains.
Well, I find it ironic. Here in the Willamette Valley, we grow a fair amount of soft white wheat, and then in eastern Oregon, they grow a lot more of it. And it's all shipped to China. I think that this, like 80 to 90% of all the grains grown in Oregon are shipped to Asia. And then we import all of our grains from the closest places, Montana, and maybe a little bit's grown in eastern Oregon. So what's happening on this farm in the Willamette Valley is right now they have 500 plus acres that are in variety of organic grains, legumes, and some seeds. And so this is happening on a much larger scale than any place else in Oregon and any place else that I'm aware of, actually. So I just wonder if this is something you've tapped into, of seeing, like, because one of the things that you need to do when you grow grains efficiently is you have to actually grow them on a lot of acres. And is that more of a challenge to get that kind of acreage?
You know, in certain parts of the country, I think it's more of a challenge. And, you know, other parts of the country, probably less so. I was just in Iowa this past week, and, you know, certainly what you see there with land prices and what's going in terms of, you know, corn prices and soybean prices, you know, it's just astronomical. And what people are getting for those products, but then also what the land prices are doing there, it's really beyond belief. So in places like that right now in the country, it's a really tough time to bust into the market if you're doing that. You know, but it is an issue of scale, you know, scale related to land and landowner, or at least acreage rented, the machinery utilized, the skill level of the farmer, everything from, you know, basic planting again all the way to the mechanics. And then you get into the whole issue of the processing, which is part of what you're alluding to, you know, in many ways with the export to China. You know, the processing infrastructure is also very costly, and if you're trying to break into that market and be able to actually, you know, work with a processor, you know, that can be a huge challenge. So very often when you see communities that are actually being successful in terms of the staple crops, it's because there's a processor who's been willing to step up to the plate, provide the appropriate infrastructure, deal with the level of scale with which the farmers are beginning at, and then also being willing to work with the distribution and the marketing. So it's not even just the production, you know, it's also the rest of the food system, if you will, the whole chain and breaking into that.
Well, one of the ironies that I see here in Willamette Valley, which when I moved here 40 years ago, there was a lot of food, local food grown here. There used to be a lot of canneries. There were frozen food plants, and there were a lot of mills, grain mills, and they've all been dismantled. And so now the challenge for the groups that are and the individuals who are trying to work on rebuilding a food shed here is they have to rebuild all this infrastructure. And I wonder if this is this common throughout the country, that there used to be local infrastructure and it's just all been dismantled?
Without a doubt. And I think you bring out one of the most important parts in this whole conversation there, Barbara, is because that, you know, we did spend 2 to 3 generations just, you know, unbuilding, you know, that infrastructure, taking it apart, removing it. And, you know, right now it's cost intensive to put it back. You know, we have the farmers and the processors have to know that the markets are going to be there once they invest in it. And then you've got the regulatory environment, you know, which is, you know, much more, I hesitate to use the word extreme, perhaps. It's much, much more rigorous. And so, you know, really building to that regulatory environment is also incredibly tough. So this is an issue that's being faced all around the country. And it's part of the argument that I try to make in the book here is that, you know, I think we've got to be really careful with these conversations about local, because we need to be very strategic about where we put in this infrastructure. We need to try to make sure that these, you know, new visions are successful as much as possible. And we have to realize that, again, this is really the work of a generation to rebuild all of this. It's just going to take time, capital, patience, and then also their market demand.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Philip Ackerman-Leist, who's author of Rebuilding the Food Shed. And we're talking about how do we rebuild local food systems in our communities so that we can eat local food and support our communities and also make them available to everyone. We haven't solved that problem yet, and I don't think we will today, but I want to get into one of the things that fascinates me the most in your book, which is the whole issue of the waste end. You alluded to that in the beginning of the show, you know, that we have to be concerned from soil to soil, basically from the soil that we plant our food in to basically how we rebuild it at the end. But let's talk about what happens generally with the waste stream and how that needs to be reshaped.
Sure, and I think more folks are aware now than they were even a couple of months ago, you know, about what's going on in terms of waste, and that's because the Natural Resource Defense Council has done such a great job in getting the figures out there. At last, they're there, and I think most of the public, when I ask at different talks, you know, many of the people in the audience know that 40% of the food that we actually produce is wasted in the United States, and that's just incredibly egregious. And when you look at the recapture of that food, you know, it can go in different places. It hopefully, first of all, it goes to the charitable food system, if at all possible. It can go to livestock as well. It can go into composting, which makes sense. In some cases, it can go into anaerobic digestion, which I believe you have a facility. I don't know if it's up and running in Portland now. And, you know, but also it's being thrown in the landfill. And of that organic food waste, we're only recapturing about 3% right now. So, you know, that's all. It's lost energy, lost nutrients, lost opportunities to feed people. And as folks in the Southwest reminded me recently when I was in Arizona, it's also lost water. And so, you know, it's one of the most egregious sins, I think, of our food system at this point in time. And it's really a way we can capitalize upon our local food systems, because municipalities are charged with controlling waste, you know, and really dealing with it at the tail end. So as a municipality, if we can stop seeing that as a, you know, a lost opportunity, and really transforming that into fertility, rebuilding the fertility of our local communities and our food sheds, then we're really on to something.
Well, we talk about the chemicals, or actually the elements that are in necessary for healthy soil, and basically it's carbon, phosphorus, potassium, and nitrogen. Mm-hmm. And that also is right now, we particularly with phosphorus and nitrogen, are two serious pollution issues in our streams. It's causing the famous dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, where the Mississippi River flows with all those nutrient runoffs from fertilizer and just kills the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, carbon binds with oxygen, becomes carbon dioxide, and is causing climate change. So how is it that, I think actually one of the things I really liked in your book, you talk about the all these things when they're in the air are bad, or when they go into the water, but when they're in the soil, they're great. So how do we get those four elements back into the soil and hold them there and actually value them, as opposed to, I mean, it seems like we produce them artificially and then we throw them away naturally.
Right. I think you posed the question really well there. And, you know, it is so much an issue of really organic matter, as we talk about it in terms of soil science. And anytime we can actually rebuild our soils, you know, by virtue of utilizing organic matter, you know, really trying to capture all of those elements, and then we lock them into the soil ecosystem. You know, they're there, they're available to plants, but typically if things are well managed, and they don't just escape, you know, they're there on a slow release capacity, which really makes sense in terms of what we're trying to do, you know, with producing plants of various sorts, whether they be for crops or for livestock. So, you know, every move we make that more resembles nature, you know, we move one step closer really to climate mitigation and also to minimizing pollution. So it only makes sense in my view that we follow natural processes as much as possible in order to really have a sane ecosystem as well as a safe ecosystem.
Now, you mentioned about aerobic composting and anaerobic digesting. And let's just describe a little bit about what each one is. And then I wanted to get into some of the challenges of anaerobic digesting, which sounds great until you get into the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a challenge. And, you know, so aerobic composting, is one of the ways in which we can actually start to capture these nutrients. It's typically the simplest for communities, and that's not to say it's simple, because it's not. But actually pulling the organics out of the system, you know, and those are related to food and also yard waste and debris as well. But actually, you know, putting those in many cases into windrows, sometimes these days actually putting them in warehouses where you can control the elements a little bit better, and allowing the composting process, you know, to continue there naturally until you, you know, in the end, you've got a really nice soil to work with. You know, the other is one that's up and coming, and that's anaerobic digestion, which involves more infrastructure, obviously more capital to get started. But that's containing everything and allowing, you know, this composting process, if you will, to go on in anaerobic conditions. And in that case,
let's explain the difference between aerobic and anaerobic.
Yeah, so the anaerobic is without air. Great.
And anaerobic uses oxygen as part of the process.
Right, and also as a result is going to give off carbon dioxide. And the anaerobic digestion is going to give off methane, but because you're doing that in a closed, sealed environment, you're able to capture that methane. And if you're doing things well, then you're utilizing that methane, you know, as a gas, and it might be actually for fuel for the vehicles that you use to collect waste, or you might use that as a means of generating electricity, as many folks do here in Vermont and other places, which is often called cow power.
Now, there's actually one of the first anaerobic digesters I heard about is in Tillamook, Oregon, which is as famous as in our local area as Vermont is for its cows. Mm-hmm. And so that was a thing that Tillamook County built a number of years ago to deal with all the cow manure, and that's, mm-hmm. they're generating power, I think, ultimately to serve a good part, you know, a nice percentage of the community. But I understand that when you use anaerobic digesting on a really large scale, like some of the confined animal feed operations in California, that you run into trouble and that they actually don't work on a large scale. I'm wondering what you know about that.
Yeah, haven't run into it on the large scale. You know, typically the problems that are here that are associated with anaerobic digestion are, related to actually to what you're using in terms of what you're putting into the system. You know, making sure that it's rich enough. That is, in many cases, that there's enough nitrogen available there. So I'm not quite sure on the scale. One of the critiques that is certainly out there with anaerobic digestion and large scale and very often confined animal operations is the question of whether it actually really promulgates that kind of agricultural activity. That's been one of the concerns that's been voiced here in Vermont and other places. So that's typically the concern that I've heard raised. So I'm not quite sure what the issue was in terms of that scale.
Well, one last subject. It'd be nice to talk a lot longer because things just keep popping into my head. So maybe we'll talk some more another time on things that we're not going to really get on today. But there's a whole issue of biodiversity, which I think is a cornerstone of creating local food systems. And I want to talk about what does that mean? And what is the connection between biodiversity in what we plant and maybe larger diversity in terms of who is farming and who gets to eat?
Yeah, great. Well, you know, the biodiversity is an enormous issue, and by making a food system that is so both national and international and homogenized, you know, we've really minimized the biodiversity that's out there in terms of what we're actually utilizing, you know, for seeds, for fruits, also for livestock. I just finished a course literally this morning with my students on biodiversity issues in agriculture focused on livestock. And, you know, and very often, those particular species or cultivars, breeds, they're tightly related to the history, the culture, and the ecology of a particular area. So by homogenizing, we really have sacrificed, you know, this adaptation that's gone on generation after generation. So the effort really here is to bring that biodiversity back so that things are better adapted, in theory, hopefully more resilient as we're facing climate change and other economic and energy challenges. So, you know, that biodiversity is a really important piece. Obviously, also there's the biodiversity surrounding our farms that we need to protect. And certainly what I saw in Iowa, that's not happening well enough. You know, it's no longer hedgerow to hedgerow. It's take out the hedgerows, you know, and the biodiversity there. And then there's the whole notion, as you say, the diversity of the number of people who are involved, you know, in these local or community-based food systems. I think we've made some mistakes as we've pushed out, you know, the local food systems, you know, across the country. We really have forgotten to bring to the table some of the most disenfranchised people who are out there, not just working in our farm fields, but also in the processing sector. You know, and very often these are people of Hispanic origin, you know, other cultural backgrounds. And they're people that we really need to pay attention to because in many ways our food system is built upon their backs, very literally, too literally probably. So, you know, hopefully as we talk about local in the future, we can do a much better job in understanding the diversity that should be there in those conversations.
Well, I hope we can talk a little bit more about local in the future again. So we'll stay in touch.
Great.
Been really enjoying talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Barbara. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking this morning with Philip Ackerman Leist, who's author of Rebuilding the Food Shed, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. In the upper right-hand corner of the webpage, there's a bar where you can type in Locus Focus and today's date, and the show will come up. Someday we'll have our website totally fixed and we can go back to the old way of finding things. Next week we'll be talking about cap and trade and some problems it poses with senior editor of Yes Magazine, Madeline Ostrander. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Michael McDade, and welcome to Locus Focus, Michael. It's nice to have you here helping us out. We're going to go out with some music by Tracy Nelson. Thanks for listening.
Well, you can hi-hat me all the time, and you may never come my way. Mother Earth is waiting for you. There's a debt you've got to pay. I don't care how rich you are. I don't care. Back to mother.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 Illahee Lecture Series on Wednesday, May 8th, when we'll broadcast a talk by Jeffrey Clements.
An attorney and author, Jeffrey Clements is the co-founder of Free Speech for People, a national, nonpartisan campaign challenge, the creation of constitutional rights for corporations, overturn Citizens United versus FEC, and strengthen American democracy and self-government. Clements is the author of Corporations Are Not People.
Jeffrey Clements will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 8th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/Illahee2013.
Particles on the Wall.
An exploration of the effects of nuclear technology on the Pacific Northwest and the world.
Particles on the Wall.
An exhibit of art, literary works, science, and historical memorabilia that describes the human and environmental impact of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Particles on the Wall.
May 3rd through June 14th, second floor gallery in the EcoTrust building.
Particles on the Wall.
Co-sponsored by Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and KBOO Community Radio.
Particles on the Wall.
Information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Coming up on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman interviews author Mary Roach about her new book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, Will Hall speaks with Sarah Davidow, psychiatric survivor and director of the Western Mass Recovery Learning Community, about the politics of language and labels, as well as the innovative programs being pioneered by the Western Mass RL. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Mary Roach, is the author of five books, including Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, and Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. Her writing has appeared in Outside, Wired, National Geographic, and the New York Times Magazine. She's here today to talk about her latest book, the New York Times bestseller, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Welcome to Health Watch, Mary Roach.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So when I was in medical school, our anatomy teacher called the human being a glorified tube. And it feels like you're essentially structuring the book as a journey or a voyage down the glorified tube from one end to the other. I think that's a pretty ingenious way to put the book together.
Yeah, well, it made the task of structuring the book a little simpler. Was we're starting at the nose and we're ending at the tail. And I think that since some of the perhaps ickier things are happening further down, you kind of you start up in the the cleaner end of things. And by the time you make your way down, I guess people are getting used to being in there. So I kind of want to gradually move them along toward the end that way. So it was kind of a nice way to structure it.
So let's take our listeners down a mini version of this voyage from nose to rectum, and start with the interesting character Horace Fletcher, who's not only interesting because he's extreme in his ideas and super eccentric, but also amazingly influential at the time.
Yeah, Horace Fletcher was not an MD. He didn't have a medical background, but he became convinced that very, very, very thorough chewing, and we're talking at the extremes, 700 chews for a bite of shallot was one example he gave. He